today, Called to the Demons, a conversation with Michael Salerno. Late one night, after watching an episode of a popular paranormal television show, Michael Salerno had a light bulb moment that made him want to make his life mission to help those who were demonically oppressed. From there, Michael began research into demonology and would eventually strike up a close friendship with Lorraine Warren. After many years of learning and studying how to help those affected by demons, Michael dove headfirst into case after case of those being tormented by dark entities. Today, we hear the story of his journey and his life work on the Grave Talks.
Actually, it's the light bulb went off in 2008. So not too long ago.
Yeah.
I had a near-death experience. It wasn't like I got in a car accident or something, but something that I had a MRSA infection.
Mm-hmm.
And MRSA is one of those antibiotic resistive superbugs.
Yeah.
And by the time that it was caught, they said that I was about 12 hours away from all my organs starting to shut down, and I very well could have died.
Wow.
So they had me on some high powered antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
And I had about a 6-month recovery at my house, and you know, I had IVs and stuff hanging off of me, and my wife came in and she said, "Look, I know you're bored. Why don't you watch this show? I know you haven't seen anything. It's called A Haunting."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Oh, geez, haunted stuff. I don't know." And she said, "Just watch it. Give it a chance." Now, I hadn't watched Ghost Hunters. I hadn't watched any of that stuff because I didn't buy it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be honest with you. I didn't think that it would ever affect my life at all.
Mm-hmm.
So while I watched this show, it was about a paranormal investigator that became possessed. She came across a satanic worship site, and it had been booby-trapped, and she was attacked by a demon, was going through the stages of demonic obsession and all the way to possession. And her sister stopped her when she was under possession, and her sister happened to be a Catholic and was wearing a cross, and the demon took over the woman that was possessed by this demon, and her face contorted and turned demonic, and she looked at her sister and said, "What is it that you love about your God so much? What's he ever done for you?" And the sister that was not possessed grabbed her cross and she said, "Well, he's my protector. That's who he is to me." And the other sister and the demon fled. Well, for some reason, that turned on a light switch in my head. I rewound it. I watched it. I rewound it. I watched it again. I rewound it and watched it again. That same scene. And it just turned on a light bulb. I never felt anything like it before. It was really weird. I called my wife in and I said, "Hey, listen, you got to watch this with me." And she said, "Oh, okay, you know, I got to watch it with you." And we got to that, and I said, to the end of it, and I said, "That's what I'm supposed to be doing." And she looked at me and she said, "What, getting possessed?" I said, no, I'm not supposed to be getting possessed. I'm supposed to be helping people with these kind of hauntings." And she said, "But, okay, I don't understand how this is coming to you, because you didn't even believe in it an hour ago."
Yeah.
And I said, I don't know. So I grabbed the IV and I went down to the bookstore in town, the used bookstore. And I bought every book I could possibly find on the paranormal, on ghost hunting, on Ouija boards, on tarot cards, on you name it. If they had it used, I bought it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the books that I bought happened to be The Demonologist by Ed and Lorraine Warren.
Mm-hmm.
So I read through the other books and no, that's not it. That's not the message. Ouija boards, nope, that's not the message. And I read The Demonologist. I closed the book. I said, that's the message. I am supposed to be doing the work that the Warrens were doing.
Mm-hmm.
I need to be helping people with these issues and the way that Ed did it. So he was kind of a mentor to me, even though he died 2 years before that.
Mm-hmm.
I never met Ed, but I have some very interesting things in common with him. But anyway, I got the book. I read the book. Within a year, I had met Lorraine. I went to an evening with Lorraine at her house, and where she would talk to people for a good hour and a half. Then you go in and see the occult museum, and you go visit Ed's grave, and then you went to a dinner, and you got to hang out with Lorraine and ask her any questions that you wanted. And that was it opened a door for me. I got home that night afterwards, and it was a very good experience. I enjoyed it a lot. I got to talk to Lorraine a lot. I got to talk to Tony Spiro a lot. So I sat down and I wrote Lorraine a handwritten letter.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't email her. I mean, she was 89 at the time. Yeah. Not that she didn't read email, but, you know, a letter is always a nice sentiment.
Sure.
So I wrote her a letter, and I thanked her so much for inviting us into her home. And I told her what I did and what I thought about the paranormal. And I asked her, if I ever have an issue with a demonic case, can I call on her?
Mm-hmm.
And I mailed it. Well, about a month later, my cell phone rang and I didn't recognize the number, and I answered it, and the woman said, hello, is Michael there? And I said, yes, this is Michael. She said, well, this is Lorraine Warren. At first I didn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, well, that does sound like her. And so I started talking to her, and she said, listen, I haven't gotten a letter like that in a long time. I really appreciate it. You could call on me anytime. And we kind of became friends after that. I mean, if she had surgery, I'd go visit her in the hospital. I'd go up and visit her on the weekends and talk to her, which was at about an hour drive.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually came out and helped me with a couple cases.
Mm-hmm.
With Tony. And what a privilege and an honor to actually have Lorraine come out to a case of yours.
Sure.
Never mind two. It's kind of like I play guitar and my favorite band is AC/DC and the guitarist invites me on stage. I mean, you know, it's weird.
Sure.
So it's just a really, I don't know, if you're going to be in the paranormal world and you're going to deal with demonology, to be invited into the Warren's inner circle is a very good feeling.
Sure.
And I found out that Ed Warren was in the Navy.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the Navy also. Now, a lot of people have been in the military, but we actually had the same exact job in the Navy.
Wow.
He was a gunner's mate, and I was a gunner's mate. And now we're both, well, I'm a demonologist now, and he was one of the first demonologists,
mm-hmm.
if you will. So, I started my own group called East Coast Angels, and I decided to call it Paranormal Rescue instead of Investigations, because I do things a little differently than the standard ghost hunter that you'll see on TV. I am a Catholic demonologist, and I use my faith and religion to actually help solve a lot of the cases that we get. I don't set up cameras normally overnight, and I don't go in and do EVP sessions. I will go in and I'll record the interview. And when I record the interview, if there's a spirit there, it usually lets us know with EVPs without even asking a question. It will chime in when you ask questions of the people, of the clients. And it will let you know that it's there and that it's probably not happy that you're there. So I do things a little differently, and I end up either cleansing the houses myself or getting the church involved. And I work with an exorcist that is very gifted. Probably closest person to God I've ever been to is this guy. He's just makes you feel good being around him, Father Rodriguez in Monroe. So
tell me, I mean, you start out, I mean, what an interesting way to get into this, you know, in 08, you're already an adult. It wasn't like you were that into this. You know, it was just like you have this moment, this, you know, oh, my gosh, this is something I need to do. And OK, but you know nothing about it, but you go and get books and you start reading up on it. I mean, tell me how it goes from, you know, reading about it to then actually, you know, you're talking to people, you're talking to Lorraine, you're talking to others involved and you're learning about this. But between those experiences of learning about it to then actually being out there on a case, what was it like for you when you started doing that? How did you get into the field itself and go from just, you know, learning and talking about it to being active in it?
Okay, sure. So I read the books and I had, it's full of information. I was looking at things on the internet, and I started sending out emails to groups. Even to the CAPS crew, I sent one out to them. I said, well, they investigate a lot of places around me, so I'm going to throw my name in there. Someone is going to let me investigate with them so I could get some experience doing this. If this is even something that I can do.
Sure.
I mean, am I going to be scared? Am I not going to be? I didn't know. So one night on the way home from work, I stopped at the local cemetery, which is out of the way. And I got out of my truck and I said, if I could walk around this cemetery at midnight in the dark by myself and I'm okay with it and I don't have a panic attack, because I never did anything like this, I think that I can do this. So I walked around the cemetery and I didn't have any problems at all. I wasn't scared. I wasn't nervous. You know, the dark didn't bother me. I was more afraid of someone stealing my truck than any spirits that were there. I was more afraid of the living. Was a policeman going to come down and yell at me or whatever? But nothing happened. So I heard back from a local group in Connecticut, and they said, yeah, we'll definitely let you come and hang out and investigate with us, and we'll show you some stuff. So I was real excited, and I went on my first investigation with them. I learned a lot. I pretty much acted like an investigator that you'd see on TV, because that's all I knew at that point. I did EVP sessions. I asked questions. And the more I started looking into it, the more I started really learning about the religious side of it. Now, I started wanting to say a protection prayer at the beginning, and I got a little resistance from the group about it. And then I wanted to do a cleansing prayer when we left. I didn't want anything following us home. I was learning too much, too quick. And they were all about the scientific side of it. And I wanted more of the religious side of it. At least let me try and help protect all of us, because we don't know what we're dealing with.
Yeah.
And, you know, it got to be a little uncomfortable. So I decided that I wanted to try and do this the way that I think that it should be done. So I started my own group. Now, I had been with the other group for a good year. And I went and did a lot of investigations with them. But there was one case that they sent me to a local place in my area, because I was about an hour away from them. And they said, the guy is complaining that something's happening with his daughter. Could you go and just interview him? You're right down the road. Well, I went, and the guy told me that there was a spirit that was telling his four-year-old daughter to do things that she shouldn't be doing. And the last thing, the last straw, basically, was it told her to go outside at 2 a.m. and it was 0 degrees out and the parents were asleep. And she did it, but they heard her. So they went out and got her. And they asked her, why did you do that? And she said, well, this spirit in this room is telling me to do all kinds of things.
Yeah.
So when I'm listening to this, I'm thinking, all right, something needs to be done right now. This is a four-year-old kid.
Yeah.
I don't want to go back to the group and say, hey, when can everybody get together and we can get the cameras together and send these people out of their house and do the investigation and get all kinds of evidence and then give them a DVD at the end. And something needed to happen then. So I asked him if he minded if I did a small house cleansing. And he said, no, go ahead. And I did. I went around and I said prayers in each room. I was pretty new at the spiritual warfare, so there was pretty much the Our Father prayer and a St. Michael prayer in each room, and told it to leave the four-year-old alone and sprinkle holy water around. And the haunting stopped, which was great. I mean, wow, the prayer worked. This girl isn't being harassed anymore. But I got some resistance from the group saying, well, now we can't investigate because the problem's solved. So they weren't happy that I went and did the prayers and they didn't get to do the investigation. So I said, well, what about the little girl? Well, we don't know that your prayers even worked. So we butted heads a little bit, and I decided to start my own group. My own group is called East Coast Angels Paranormal Rescue, because we go in and help where other groups can't.
Sure.
And, you know, originally it was a neat idea. I was going to have, a stick with it. I was going to have all female investigators, and I was going to be like Charlie from Charlie's Angels, you know. Then I said, I'd probably end up just being a speaker box, forget it. That didn't work out too well. Plus, you know, a bunch of women, they were all great, but all together, there was a lot of arguing. So, I had to adapt and change. And I met a guy, his name is Eric Morin, and Eric has some gifts of discernment, and he can actually tell me pretty much what's at a place. So he actually became my, like, Lorraine, mm-hmm. if you will.
Yeah.
So it ended up that Eric and I both had the same views on this. And we decided to, now East Coast Angels is just actually me and Eric. And we just go and help other groups, or if someone refers a demonic case to us. We don't go ghost hunting. We don't go and, practice at a cemetery or anything. I don't need the proof that this stuff exists. I already know it.
Yeah, you're going in from the standpoint of it already existing and not questioning it. It's just, okay, it's there. Now, how do we deal with this, and how do we help the family?
Right. And is it real?
Sure.
Because a lot of demonic symptoms look like insanity. Mm-hmm. And a lot of insanity can look like demonic problems.
Sure.
So you have to make sure that it's something demonic. I don't like doing the placebo prayer. I don't like doing it if it's not necessary. Praying is always good, but I don't like doing the exorcism prayer unless it's needed. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I want to make sure what's at this place is demonic. And we have different methods that we can do that, that I've learned through the years that I've been doing this, and from Lorraine and Tony and a lot of the teachings of Ed. So
let's talk about that a little bit. I mean, because obviously you want to, you know, make sure that what you're dealing with in any case is not a mental health issue. Because like you said, that can look very much like a demonic possession and vice versa. So when you go in and, you know, the signs kind of point to these are the symptoms, it could really go either way. What are some ways that you can determine as you begin learning about the case and the individuals involved that point you into either this person needs psychiatric help or this person needs some sort of spiritual intervention?
Well, there are some things that we do. Number one, I will do a blessing with blessed oil from the church on the person's forehead. Each person that lives there, I do that. And there will either be a reaction or there won't. Okay. If there's a demon present, it is not going to like that blessed oil at all. And the person will complain. They may dodge it like, you know, a kid trying to avoid a spoonful of medicine, you know. I would do religious provocation in the house and ask for a sign. In the name of Jesus Christ, to give a sign. I will not command it in my name, because a demon is not intimidated by a human being at all. The only thing it fears is Jesus. So I ask Jesus to come and do the work for me. I don't do anything. I just invite him into the home. And a demon does not like that. And, you know, it may knock things over. It may take the person over right in front of you. The main thing that we look for is, when did this start? Why did it start? We have to find the invitation that was given, because there has to be some sort of invitation, unless it's through witchcraft. Witchcraft can cause a demonic problem as a spell cast or a curse put on someone. But I lost track of what I was saying. I'm sorry.
No, we're talking about the how you're going through the process and how you're determining if this is something that is demonic or if this is something where someone needs psychiatric help.
Right. So I'll do the interview. We will ask so many different questions, and a lot of different ways. Eric is in law enforcement, so he does the interviews. He's pretty thorough, and he's very good at reading people. So we'll ask questions, you know, all the way back to, all right, were you abused as a child? Did you ever use a Ouija board? Did you ever have someone possibly curse you? I mean, did you go to an antique store and buy something that if it is, where is it? Can we see it? Then we'll actually do some prayers in the house. And there will be a reaction or there won't be. I will take a holy relic and I will put it behind someone's neck. And if they have a reaction to it, then there's a good chance there's something demonic there. Now, I also have a coin that I put on the back of someone's neck to see if there's a reaction. It's kind of a test, you know. A demon will know if it's a relic or if it's nothing, a coin.
Yeah.
Just like regular water versus holy water. There's different tests that you can do. But mostly, these people, they can describe some of the things in such detail that it actually fits the war plan that the demons have, because they follow the same path every time. Infestation to oppression to possession. First it starts with knocks and bangs. We'll look for when things start happening. Does it happen at 3 in the morning? because that is the witching hour. That is Satan's high time. Okay, that's where he's the strongest, because it's the opposite of when Jesus actually died on the cross at 3 p.m. Mm-hmm. So everything is opposite. There'll be knocks. Knock three times. The demonic use that as kind of an insult to the Trinity, the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Things will come in threes. If they have scratches on them, are they in threes? We had one case where the scratches were so perfect that we didn't think that it was possible that a demon could do it. And we found a fork that had three prongs that matched it perfectly in the house. Mm-hmm. It wasn't demonic. So we find the demonic things that are happening in the house and compare them to, is there another solution to it?
Sure.
Is it something else? Or is it actually this? Now, when it is, we go home and we listen to the audio also. Huh? I'm sorry, I have to go back to that.
Sure.
Because there will be EVPs, even though we're not asking questions, that they will let themselves be known. So after we deal with this and we ask their medical history, if they've had a psychological evaluation, would they be willing to get a psychological evaluation? If we find evidence that it is a demonic haunt, then we will actually do something. Now, I'll give you two examples of when it wasn't.
Yeah.
One woman, she was in her 60s. She was claiming that there was an incubus that was attacking her nightly and raping her. Mm-hmm. Now, you want to help this woman. I wanted to help this woman so much. Mm-hmm. And she described demonic symptoms perfectly in this case. And we went and we did the prayers. We did all kinds of stuff. We could not find any evidence or any invitation that this was happening. So I finally told her, her name was Rose. I said, Rose, listen, if we're going to go any further, I'm not seeing any evidence of a demonic haunting. Even though you say this is happening, I'm not seeing any evidence. In order to get the church involved, you'll have to go to get a psychological evaluation. Would you do that? And she said, no, absolutely not. I'm not crazy. I said, well, I have no way of determining if you're crazy or not. But if a doctor would give you a pill that would make the rapes seem to stop or cause them to stop completely, would you take the pill? And she said, no, because I'm not crazy. I said, then I can't help you. She wouldn't accept that it's a possibility that she was not demonically attacked.
Yeah, that there was something psychological.
And,
yeah.
Right. And it definitely was. And she said to me, I really wish you would just tell me that you're afraid of it. I said, okay, Rose, you know what? I'm afraid of it. And she said, now you're lying to me. I said, I can't win. That one was definitely a mental issue, and we were unable to help her.
Sure.
I went up and I did a case in Maine where the guy called me, and he talked about a small demon that was taunting him all the time. And some of the things that he told me led me to believe that, yes, this sounds like it could be real. We got to go up, and I'm going to drive to Maine and see this guy, talk to him, do the interview, check everything out. And then I'm just going to do the exorcism prayer in the house because, all right, I don't have unlimited funds and stuff to go up and stay and do overnight and drive back and forth to Maine. So I wanted to at least do the prayer up there while I was there. So we did the prayer, we did the investigation, all the questions. And as soon as I finished the prayer, I said to him, I said, how do you feel? Is this thing still here? And he looks around and then he looks down at me I mean, down at the thing, looks back at me and says, "No, he's still here." He says, "Screw you." I said, "Okay. I am not getting anything else here that shows me that there's a demon, that there's demonics in this house."
Yeah.
So the wife pulls me aside and she says, "What do I do here? Do I just drop him off at the nut house?" I said, "No, I don't think that's a good idea."
Yeah.
I said, "But he should get checked out. All right. Get him checked out. If he comes back and there's nothing wrong with him, then yes, I will come back and I will try and help him as much as I possibly can." She said, "Okay." Well, I did not hear back from him for 6 years. I could not get a hold of him. And he called me after 6 years and he says, "I just wanted to let you know, thank you." And I said, "All right, Tom, what for?" And he says, "You told my wife to have me checked out, and I did. I went, I saw a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist realized that I was having issues. He's actually got me on a medication. I'm being treated. And it all stopped when I started getting help."
And in the end, you helped, you know?
I helped. I really did nothing. But by doing nothing, it did help him.
Yeah.
Because he was able to get the psychological help that he actually needed. He said that he wrote a book. And that is one big chapter in it of me going up there, doing the prayer and telling him that he needed to be psychologically evaluated, and that solved his whole life issue.
Yeah.
I was floored. I was so happy to hear that because, you know, so if you don't hear back, you never know how it ends up. But the fact that he did that and called me and told me, that made me feel really good that I was able to figure out whether it was or wasn't, you know?
Well, and especially to people who are in that situation, even though it may not be demonic to them, it certainly feels like it. And they know no different than saying this is what it is until they can get the help that they need. What was it like, though? So we talked about, you know, some of the cases where you've gone in and you've determined that this was not anything demonic. It was something that was psychological going on. But oftentimes when we start talking about possessions or demonic activity and such, we're always kind of jumping into, and then the exorcist showed up. And then, but before that step even gets there, what are you walking into on a case where truly there is something demonic going on? What is that person like? I mean, I'm assuming you're not walking in and pea soup is being spit across the wall. It, you know, probably a lot more tame in many cases as to the signs and the possibilities of what are going on with the individual.
Well, you know what? A lot of times, as soon as we get there, everything calms down and nothing happens. Because the one thing that these demons are is smart. And if I go in and we don't find anything, they're going to be like, "See, we fooled them. That's great." And sometimes that happens.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes we go in and it's quiet. But once I start doing Latin prayers in a house that is demonically infested, there's usually a response. It'll draw it out in anger for hearing the Latin prayers. And for some reason, the demonics do not like to hear the Latin language. I think with these prayers, it was the original language that it was written in, so it has more power. I've learned how to say them, and I've had people that were under possession when they came out of it. They remembered some, and they said, "When you prayed in English, it irritated it. But when you started doing the prayers in Latin, it infuriated it. And really, it was like you punched it in the nose." So I try and use the Latin prayers. But before we go in, I say some prayers of protection over us. And if it is a demonic case, and I'm getting ready to maybe do the exorcism prayer in the house, I'll fast for 3 days before I do it. And I will also go to confession and talk to my priest, because most of these cases that we're going into, another group has gone in and they've said, okay, this is out of our wheelhouse. This is too much going on here. They need help, and they call us. So we go in, we talk to the family, we interview the family, we try and find the root cause, like I said. But going in there, you know, sometimes nothing happens, and sometimes the person will lock themselves in a room and not want to see us at all. You never know. You're going into chaos is what you're going into.
Mm-hmm.
In almost every case, it wants you to think that they are crazy, because I can't help with crazy. I can help with the demonic problem, but crazy, I can't fix.
That wraps up part one of our conversation with Michael Salerno. In part two, what were some of the signs that Michael received that made him take a step back from being a demonologist? What was the event that brought him back to helping those in need of spiritual intervention? Even when a family or individual follows the plan outlined by an exorcist, are there times where no matter what, the demon won't leave? When a demon is exorcised from a person, does it simply move on to another vessel? And can a demon torment more than one person at a time? Those questions we discuss with Michael in part two of our conversation today. To hear it, become a gravekeeper, go to patreon.com/thegravetalks to sign up to be a gravekeeper and get access to all of our bonus material, as well as part two of all of our episodes and advanced episodes, all commercial free. It helps keep our show on the air. Without your support, we would not exist. Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.